You're listening to Something You Can Feel, a Black Art History podcast. I'm your all-around artsy host, Kiara, and I'd like to thank you so much for tuning in. There might be some coarse language, so viewer discretion is advised. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy the show.
Are you ready to start?
I guess so, as if recording.
We ready.
Okay, this is the first episode of Something You Can Feel. Yay.
Hey, everybody. Yay.
Black Art History Podcast, exploring issues of identity in Black contemporary art. I'm Kiara. I'm your host. I'm an interdisciplinary artist, art theorist. I'm a Sagittarius. I have a cat. I'm a cat mom. And then we have two special guests. Introduce yourselves. Tell us about yourselves. Who are you?
I'll start. So my name is Kamisha Gray. I am Kiara's aunt.
Hey, Kamisha.
Okay, we're recording, so we need to be professional. So again, my name is Kamisha Gray. I am Kiara's aunt. I am currently a director of programs for an organization called Saga Education. I used to be in my former positions. I used to be a teacher, an instructional coach, an assistant principal and principal, all in New Orleans and Chicago. But then I recently decided to come back home to Chicago about 2 years ago to be closer to my family. I'm also a doctoral student working on my PhD in educational administration. And I'm also a part-time business owner, and I have a skincare consulting firm. So if you are interested in skincare, please let me know. It's with Roden and Fields. Does wonderful, wonderful work on your skin. I am not a cat mom, but I'm a dog mom, and I have an elderly dog. His name is Gizmo, and he is literally 18 years old. And that's a little bit about me. Oh, for fun, what I like to do is hot yoga. I like concerts, festivals, and summertime shy.
My name is Kiana. I'm actually Kiara's mom. I'm not a cat or dog mom. I'm just a regular old mama, a Kiara. I am a teacher. I teach math at City Colleges of Chicago. I've been there 20-something years. Looking forward to retiring very, very soon. I am not an art person at all. I teach math. And I'm a Scorpio. In my fun time, I like to hang out with my friends and my family and partake in new restaurants.
And drink.
That too. Partake in new restaurants.
And alcohol.
Oh, and since we're all doing our signs, I'm an Aquarius, and it's going to be my birthday this week. I will be turning 50.
That actually leads to my question. So I have a question for each of you. Kamisha. Like Kamisha said, she's turning 50. This will actually be released, I think, the day after your birthday. So, or the day on your birthday. It depends on when I edit it. But it will be released somewhere near your birthday. So Kamisha's turning 50. Woo! What'd you say?
Nothing.
People you can't take everywhere. You just can't. You can't bring them to podcasts. You can't. They just don't know how to act. They don't understand the rules. Okay.
So, what are five things that you've done or experienced that you would say has really made the past 50 years enjoyable? You'll answer this at the end.
Okay, I can't answer it now.
No.
Okay, I got you.
And then mommy, I feel like you've been a very supportive art parent, and a lot of people have not been had supportive art parents. What advice would you give to who are adults who are artsy and are you writing this down?
Yes, I am, because I'm prepared.
Okay. What advice would you give to someone who doesn't have like family validation in their arts life? What advice would you give to them?
Am I saving this until the end as well?
Both of you are saving this until the end.
Okay.
Why are you writing stuff down?
So I can really ponder the answer and give you a thoughtful answer.
Now you know she ain't writing that down.
I am.
Okay. Are we ready to start?
Yes, we are.
And then I'm going to It's a slideshow too. So you, I know some of us need help.
I think that was for me.
Okay. So this is Donnell Wolfert. There's conflicting information about when she was born. Either she was born in 1977 in Georgia or in 1980 in Detroit. She's a visual artist and performer based in the Bronx. She graduated with a bachelor's in graphic design from Yale in 2004. And she participated in exhibitions and performances across the world, including New York, Amsterdam, Paris, Chicago, and London. She came to prominence in 2014 when her two paintings and a series of performances were commissioned to be a part of the 2014 Whitney Biennium. The Whitney, do you guys know what the Whitney is, Kamisha?
It's a museum.
Yes. Oh, you actually know. Well, tell us about it. Do you know anything about it?
I've never visited. I just know it's a museum.
Okay. Well, she was a part of the Whitney Biennial. The Whitney is a museum in New York. It is considered like a big cutting edge contemporary art museum. They host the Whitney Biennial. Do you guys know anything about those? No.
No.
Okay. So biennial is Italian for every 2 years. So they're international art shows that happen every 2 years. The Whitney has the longest running biennial of American art and is considered like a big leading biennial in terms of all the international ones. So the 2014 Whitney Biennial was particularly interesting because it came 20 years after the 1993 Whitney Biennial, which is to this day considered like it was very scrutinized at the time, and to this day it's still like a very controversial exhibition. One of the curators in it was actually Thelma Golden. Have you heard of her? She's curating, a really popular like Black curator. She's the chief curator and executive director at the Studio Museum in Harlem. And she's designing the Obama Library. She's one of the curators, so be a part of that process. But in 1993, she was an up-and-coming curator and a part of the team of folks who curated the 1993 Biennial. This is the first time a prominent museum addressed identity politics in artwork, and its artwork. There was work about the AIDS pandemic. There was work about the LA riots. This was the first time that there was a lot of lesser-known artists of color in like a big major show. At the entrance of the exhibition, there was actually a video of the Rodney King beating. And then one of the most iconic works from the biennial 1993 was these little artist tags here I'm showing. If you watch it on the YouTube, you'll see visuals, but if you're just listening, these are little artist tags and they're from Daniel J. Martinez. The front of them have the letters WMMA, which is the Whitney Museum of American Art. Yes. And then on the back, they said, "I can't imagine wanting to be white." And Martinez walked around handing these out to visitors. And so 20 years later, it's 2014, it's a 2014 biennial, and there's supposed to be like this similar revolutionary energy around it. And the Whitney even announced that this is supposed to be the most revolutionary showcase of American art ever. But what actually happens is that only nine, so there's 103 artists and only nine of them were artists of color. And so one of those was Donnell Wolfert. This is the image from the promotional stuff from her work in the 2014 biennial. She had three inclusions, two inkjet prints. They were both called joke painting or detumescence. I don't know, it's a French word, which means like sexual arousal. And this was also accompanied with a series of performances that toured the nation called Dick's Last Stand. So here's the write-up from the Whitney's website about the performances. Wolfert's performance, Dick's Last Stand, explores the central role given to the male sexual organ in both American art and politics. Perpetrating the tradition of phallic humor in popular culture, it is a reenactment of Richard Pryor's stand-up routine from the last episode of his short-lived 1977 TV show, in which he continually played with the notion that Richard Pryor, comedian, was someone who could not be pinned down or controlled, Dick's Last Stand, Honest Prior is both political humor and marks its return to the live stage, with Wolford playing Prior and Prior playing Mudbone across generations in drag. And so Wolford said that the goal of these works were to put two dicks in conversation with one another. Richard Prince, who's an American painter and comedian, Richard Prior, if you don't get the joke, it's that people's name, Richard R. Dicks. And so it's like, yeah. If you're not familiar with Richard Prince, he's an American painter who did a series of paintings in the 1980s that were these large scale canvases, and they had text from crude jokes like painted on top of them in really bright colors. Wolford stated that Richard Prince was the inspiration for her works, but what some people have noted is that Donnell's work and its aesthetics and its concept is actually very similar to Glenn Lignon. I think that's his name. Glenn Lignon's work. If you're not familiar with who he is, he's a Black American conceptual artist. He's most known for working with text. So around the same time of the 1993 biennial, he actually started creating these paintings that included text from Richard Prior routines from the 70s. And these works were pretty groundbreaking and pivotal still to this day. Do you remember going to the 30 American show?
Never heard of it.
We all went together. You did hear of it.
When did we go? Remind me of it.
I had to be like a senior in high school. Anyway, we all went to the exhibition. His work was in the exhibition, so you've seen his work before in person.
The one where we were outside?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
I don't know. You did so much in art, I just can't keep it all straight anymore.
Okay, we're gonna move on. So his work was like pretty groundbreaking, and like if you know about Black art, you probably know this work and have seen it. But when this was brought up to Donnell, she said she had never seen his work or like heard about it, which is very strange. But then someone found an interview with her from like 2001, where she actually stated that he was one of her favorite, his exhibition was one of her favorite mid-career retrospective, even though she found his work really boring. And so right now, if you're watching this or seeing this, you can see two paintings, but if you're just listening, I'm showing Glenn Lignon's work next to Donnell Wolford's, and they essentially look very similar. Lignon does his text by hand in like a stencil, and so he like kind of does that a bunch of times and like stacks them on top of one another, so he intentionally like plays with how legible the work is. So if you're seeing it right now, it's like not super clear, and you kind of have to like see it in person for it to be clear. But the one that's right next to it is Donnell Wolford's work, and if you're not seeing it, they look exactly the same, except for Wolford's is just like a printout, literally just like a printout from an inkjet printer. I'm just going to read what Lignon's painting says. Black people are afraid to death of therapists. For some reason, out of all the people on the planet in America, can I curse in front of you all? We are some motherfuckers that need therapy. You believe me, because we are fucked up. We're fucked up because we got to be insane because we ain't killed you motherfuckers. And then I'm going to move you guys out the way. The one from Donnell Wolford, it says, Richard is undressing in his apartment and he spies a young woman doing the same across the way. He extends his cock over to her windowsills and calls out, hey, babe, do you want to come over? She thinks for a moment and says, sure, I'd love to, but how will I get back? Oh, and these performances that Donnell did, she dressed up in drag wearing this like bright orange, like Richard Pryor-esque jumpsuit, and recreates like this notorious stand-up routine. Can you explain who Richard Prior is for people who are not over a certain age and know who he is?
The comic genius. So he is a comedian that my sister and I grew up with watching. He had like great stand-up shows. I think one was the Night in LA or something similar to that. But he's a comic genius. He paved the way for like the Eddie Murphys, the Dave Chappelle's, the Chris Rock's of the world. And he really addressed political satire that was going on at that particular time in America. And he just dove right into it. So he was very upfront, transparent, honest, open about his comic routines. And I think the interesting thing is to hear a little bit about his past. Like, he went through a lot growing up to even get to the point that he was at his greatest success. I'll turn it over to Kiana to add some more.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Richard Pryor kind of set the stage for comedians like Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle. People who are funny, but they talk about politics. They talk about what's really happening in the world as opposed to just telling a joke. He exposed his personal life. And like Kamisha was kind of saying, he came from an extremely troubled childhood. I think there's actually a movie about his childhood, traumatic childhood, and of course had a lot of demons, but he was very open with his past and his current struggles. And I think, I can't remember the name of that show, Kamisha, I'm thinking about, but that was after one of the incidents where I believe he set himself on fire. And then he came back, did a hilarious show, one that people say it's probably the best stand-up routine ever.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the middle age recap for the folks who haven't been here.
You're welcome.
I ask that you, thank you, put yourself back on mute. So, like you said, the Richard Pryor show. Do you know that he had a show?
I don't know he had a show. I've only seen his stand-up specials and movies that he made.
Okay, so he had a show. It began and ended in 1977. NBC had been heavily censoring the show. That's why a lot of people haven't seen it. And ultimately, they only recorded 4 episodes of it because it's considered so controversial. So in the final monologue of the show, he essentially was making fun of NBC and racism in America while performing as his alter ego, Mudbone, who's a country Mississippi man. And at the end of the performance, he received a standing ovation, but NBC never aired it. So it's a very notorious performance. And Donnell's performance, he was reenacting the last monologue that he did for the show.
Okay.
I said, what's the nigga's name you call up when the shit is wrong?
It doesn't matter, really. We've never cared about colored people. Why should we start now? Is our colored people gay? So the shit is funky, boy. They be funky. So I'm going to do a little stand-up thing here, and I wanted to do Mudbone. And y'all comfortable? Good. Welcome. Mudbone had told me, I need a stool here. Can props bring me up a stool? Little stool here. You might get on TV and make some money. Because Mudbone liked to sit down. So Mudbone is an old man I met in Peoria, where I'm from. I'm from Peoria. Thank you for that little applause. Is an old man, and he was interesting. He was retired, and here's a white boy bringing me a chair. Don't look nothing like a stool, but he got a chair. See, white boys do their work, boy. He'll bring a chair. You ask a nigga, it's like, motherfucker, here's a stool, motherfucker, here, sit on that.
And so I Dick's Last Stand is touring the nation. There's actually more than one person playing Donnell. And the clip I just showed, that was actually an actress named Jennifer Kitwell. She's actually one of 5 actresses who make up Donnell Wolford. And through this tour, it's revealed that Donnell is actually not a person, but a project and a fictitious character created by Joe Scanlon or Scanlon. And if you can't see Joe Scanlon right now, he is a white man. And right now I'm showing an image of him called Pay Dirt. And if you can't see it, it's can one of you describe it?
White man with dirt on his face?
What does it look like?
It looks like he's attempting to do blackface.
Yes. So yeah. This is Joe Scatlin. He's an artist and professor at Princeton, and he's the former director of their visual arts program. He came up with the idea for Donald Warford in 1999 while he was a sculpture professor at Yale. The name Donnell Wolford was actually taken from Scanlon's favorite football player from the Bears. He actually lived in Chicago for 10 years, and allegedly he hung out with the Astor Gates and Kerry James Marshall. I'll talk more about the Astor Gates later, but if you don't know who Kerry James Marshall is, he's a very prominent Black painter. I think his work, he has the most expensive piece of Black contemporary art that's ever been sold. And I think P. Diddy bought it or something like that. But those are two Black men, so it's a prominent Black male artist, so it would be interesting if they all hung out. But in 1999, he was creating these wooden sculptures. They're what you see on the right, that reference cubism. Do you guys know about cubism?
Isn't that where cubes or other geometric shapes are used to portray an image?
Yes. Right, I'm shocked.
Cubes? Like, I could think of one where there was it was a woman. It actually showed our bodies are geometric shapes, or abstract images of geometric shapes.
Wow.
I told you she did her homework.
I was going to say, usually she don't know nothing.
Thank you all so much for that support.
Welcome. But yeah, cubism, that's what it looks like aesthetically, but it's a 20th century avant-garde art music in Europe. And so essentially around this time, like, European artists were going to West Africa for the first time. And essentially cubism is just like their appropriations of West African math. So cubism is just white people just trying to do Black art. And so Scanlon felt that the,
Typical.
Thank you, Kamisha.
I thought we were supposed to be on mute.
But that's what Scanlon's collages at the time were about. And he started to like look at the works and was like, this would be more interesting if someone else made them. And specifically, he said someone who could exploit their historical and cultural references. And I guess he thought about it for a minute and said that the collages looked like they've been done by a Black woman. And so that's how Donnell Wolford was born. Originally, Donnell Wolford was played by Namik Minter, who is one of Scanlon's Black women students at the time. It's interesting because it seems like all the actresses at one point were students of his, which is weird. But yeah, she has since reversed her approval of the project overall and is no longer associated with it. Coco Fusco, who is a very influential Cuban performance artist, she did this cool piece in the 80s or maybe 70s where she was like in a box and like another artist was in a box, and they were like dressed in like native outfits, like, but kind of performative native outfits, like something you might see on like a stereotypical like image of a Native American. And they like put themselves in boxes. I want to say it was like the middle of LA, and they were talking about how like Americans fetishize looking at like these stereotypical images of Native people. But that was a really pivotal performance work at that time, and this is like the birth of performance artists happening at that time. So Coco Fusco is a really big influential artist related to that era. But at the time that Joe Scanlon was teaching at Yale, she was also teaching at Yale, and here's what she said that people said about him. Former Black students of Scanlon's from that time recall that he would pepper his studio visits with questions about Black culture as if he were attempting to draw cultural knowledge out of them. It is not insignificant that while Scanlon's critics often depict him as an all-powerful, older white man taking advantage of younger Black women, the context that gave rise to Donnell Wolford was one in which racial balance of power in his workplace was shifting in favor of younger artists of color. That shift represented two intertwined threats. It challenged the presumed power relations between teacher and students, and also diminished the teacher's claim to the mastery insofar as his students possess characteristics and cultural knowledge that he could not consider his own as a result of his tutelage. Hence, rather than seeing Scanlon's work as a crude exercise in exploitation, we might conceive of it as a castration fantasy about white male erasure.
And that's so basically, it's again white people's fascination with the Black culture.
Scanlon spent developing the character, and in 2007 held auditions to cast the role of Donnell Wolford, a young and up and coming Black female artist. He ended up hiring two professional actresses, Jennifer Kidwell and Abigail Ramsey, who began touring the nation as a part of a performance called Donnell Wolford, A Narrative by Joe Scanlon. By 2012, Scanlon had transformed Donnell Wolford into an established mid-career artist. In that year, Donnell released a book and subsequent exhibition in Paris called Dick Jokes, which led to the 2014 inclusion in the Whitney Biennium. I'm showing an image right now, and it's of four Black women. It's funny to me because these are the actresses that make up the project, outside of the one who no longer wants to associate with it. None of them look alike. They're all just happen to be Black women. They're not even in like the same age range. And the first one, it just says Avatar. And so I literally think it's a stock image. And if you see it, it kind of looks just like a random stock image. If you Google like professional Black woman. It had several moments of being like controversial. I'll actually go back. It seems like the initial controversy started online during the Dick's Last Stand tour. It was actually performed at a few different major art institutions, which is interesting. One of them is the Dorchester Projects, which if you aren't familiar, it houses all of the Astor Gates projects. Do you know who the Astor Gates?
Never heard of them.
Stony Island Arts Bank. Kamisha, you live down the block. It's a bank on like 67th. If you don't, we're all from Chicago, if you're listening. So this is in Chicago. But he like grew up on the South Side, and there's a bank on 67th and Stony, I want to say. It's like an old bank, and he bought it for a dollar and turned it into a, like, it's a library. It houses the house music, like, it's a library of house music. It has an archive of, like, house music. And it also has all the Ebony and Jet. They hold the archives there. Ever since the building closed down downtown, the archives are at the Stony Island Arts Bank. So he holds just, like, a bunch of, like, different Black South Side culture and, like, this one space. And they also have a library and the biggest collection of representations of Black people from like old movies or film slides. He has like the biggest collection out there. But that's the Astor Gates, and allegedly he hung out with Scanlon. But also, interestingly enough, he allowed Dick's Last Stand to happen at the Dorchester Projects, which is part of that. And then the Studio Museum in Harlem, they actually refused to include the work. An African-American studies professor publicly called the work a travesty when it was in Oakland. And an artist in LA actually showed up to the performance with a bag over her head to protest the work. Two art and pop culture writers, Eunsung Kim and Maya Isabel McAndrew, made a manifesto called The Whitney Biennial for Angry White Women, or it just says Angry Women, they're both white, Angry Women, and it's like essentially like a manifesto in response to the project. They named two actionable responses to the work, and this is a quote from them. Joe Scanlon wanted Donnell Wolford to perform at the Studio Museum in Harlem, which only shows works by artists of African descent. The museum rejected his proposal. Whoever made that decision deserves an award. Please contact us if you are interested in receiving an original sculpture in tributary form. We've coined the hashtag Scanlon Gang and launched an accompanying Tumblr where we invite women of color and their allies to produce original Joe Scanlon's, AKA white boy art, to post online. Mm. We invite everyone to call out art world racism, privileged white aesthetic, and to call out the white male fantasy. They wrote this directly to the curators of the biennial. You don't get to appropriate diversity as a buzzword for your PR work. Besides, we know you don't know how to count. There is one Black female artist. We refuse to count your fictional Black female artist. You put the two Puerto Ricans in the basement. And How Do You Say Yam in African is a collective of 38 Black and queer artists, but barely get treated as one artist. How amazing would it be if all 38 people were counted as 38 people at the Whitney, which will record them as 40% of the museum space. They are the largest collective in the biennial, yet their real estate is virtually non-existent. And just a note about the other Black woman that's included in the 2014 biennial, they keep, like, a lot of sources say that there's another Black woman, like actual Black woman in the show, as a part of the biennial, but no one actually references her name. They just say that there was another actual Black woman, but it was like kind of hard to actually find her name or who she was or her work. By this time, Scanlon had considered that, like, he felt at this point that the Donna Wolfer project was actually a collaboration between himself and the two actresses. He stated that Jen Kidwell sees this as a political gesture, a kind of territorial claiming of the type of behavior Black artists supposedly aren't allowed to have. But I also think it is a political gesture aimed somewhat at me, a refusal to speak on my behalf. Abigail Ramsey, on the other hand, plays Donnell in a rather sunny persona who is willing to talk to anyone in a charming, slightly overenthusiastic young artist sort of way. Though she is quite amenable as an actor, Abigail's Donnell is the type of person that many denizens of the art world find annoying. Some articles have pointed this out, but there actually isn't much info or interviews with the actresses. Scanlon said that he, whenever people reach out to him, that he always offers their contact information, but no one actually reaches out to them. But here's the info I could find on Kidwell, who's the one that was playing the Richard Pryor reenactment. She said she learned about the gig on a website for actors. She is a graduate of Columbia University and has done public theater in Philly, New York, and Paris. When Scanlon initially told her about the project, she said, "I don't want to be involved in your post-colonial trash," but she changed her mind the more she talked to him about the role of identity in art. She now says it's an experiment between her and Joe about being outside of themselves. She says she's only been interviewed by a small handful of people and feels unaddressed by the public. Here's a direct quote. "I felt unaddressed. There is a Black artist present in the piece. Why am I erased from it? Why do I continue to be erased from it? I'm not interested in being a fool. I'm interested, perhaps selfishly, in art making. I'm interested in what's going to challenge me." She says that over the years, her and Ramsey, the other actresses, have gained more control over the project than they had in the beginning. She says that the Richard Pryor reenactment was actually her idea. And she said that in spite of the controversy, when they were doing the tour, the audiences were very welcoming, and only one person, I guess, said anything mean to her. And it was a professor who had worked with Richard Pryor. And he said that Richard Pryor wouldn't have liked her dressing in men's clothes. And that was the only issue. Another thing that made the controversy pretty big was this article from Ryan Wong. It's entitled "I Am Joe Scanlon." And so this is like a meta satire piece that many people thought was real. And it opened up an even bigger conversation about art because this is an Asian arts writer. The open paragraph says, "Joe Scanlon is the artist who supposedly teaches at Yale and Princeton universities. As intended, the project set off a healthy and robust debate about the realities of race, class, and gender privilege within the art world. Now that the Whitney Biennial is over and the critical debate around it has subsided, I feel it is time to put the project to rest. I am Joe Scanlon." The idea for Joe Scanlon came a few years ago when I became interested in the presence of white men within the art world. In so many other realms, straight white men are deprived of social and political authenticity. Look at the white appropriation of Black music, from blues to hip hop, the white idolization of Black athletes, or the apotheosis of white politics, Bill Clinton, resting on Black folksiness. In the art world, however, the discourse around art produced by straight white men often cast them as singular and generative geniuses. I wonder what it would be like to create a figure that, through a practice of what I like to call willful white male idiocracy, could such a project, were it successful, help to undo some of the myth of the white male genius? In Juan's article, he also posted a picture from a Facebook fight that Scallon had gotten to when, like, on Facebook, essentially, people were responding to this, and an artist posted something on her Facebook about particularly this photo of him with the dirt smeared all over his face. And she said it looked like a menstrual, and he responded, "The portrait is called Pay Dirt. The material on my face is a synthetic potting soil. I invented and patented with the idea that I had struck it rich." Again, what is the awkwardness exactly? The issue seems to be more yours than mine. Scallon also responded to Wong's piece. Someone reached out to him for an interview asking how he had he read Wong's piece. And he said he thought it was funny and thought it could have been funnier. This is directly what he said. "Too bad Wong's desire to score points overwhelmed his desire to be entertaining. And that's when it stopped being funny. Anyway, it was a funny idea and certainly worth doing. One good turn deserves another. And in that sense, validated Donnell Wolford at my expense. What do I care anyway? Either way, I can't lose." The interviewer then asks, did he think Ryan's post had any merit because it acknowledged the power structures that were at the root of the project? And Scallon said, "Well, duh. Is that something you or he thinks isn't obvious? The flaw in the tactic racism, frankly, and Ryan's satire is that he assumes I have unwavering power over Jen Kidwell, which he mimics in his power over me. If you had the pleasure of being present at one of our rehearsals, you would learn otherwise. Ultimately, from ours, Jen and Abigail's and Maya's point of view, this is really a question of people's very real inability to accept that a white man and two Black women can acknowledge their unequal power relations and still decide to happily work together. Because something that might be accomplished is greater than inequity. Because of the knowledge we have of ourselves and our relationship to one another, we aren't much troubled by other people's perception of us." The interviewer then reached back out to Ryan and asked him his thoughts on Scallon's response. And he said, "It sounds like the project has evolved and that Kidwell and Ramsey have more ownership of the project than they did in the beginning. Maybe Scallon will relinquish control of Wolford to Kidwell. Maybe he'll give her his teaching position. That would be an ideal next step in the project." And then Scallon responded, when the interviewer initially reached out to Scallon, he said it would be funny if someone wrote an "I am Ryan Wong" piece. And then Wong said back to that, he's more than welcome to create an "I am Ryan Wong" essay, of course, but for the sake of his PR, I wouldn't recommend it. Internationally exhibited artist and director of Princeton's art program goes after young part-time art writer. Plus, this could end up being an affinity loop. A la Macaulay Culkin wearing a t-shirt of Ryan Gosling, wearing a t-shirt of Macaulay Culkin. Maybe Scallon could make me a t-shirt instead. Okay. The thing that made the controversy really explode was that actually the Yams Collective, which was mentioned earlier, they decided to remove the work from the biennial altogether. I don't know if that's ever been done before, but that's a pretty big like move. Their name is, how do you say Yam in African, otherwise known as the Yams Collective. They're a group of 38 artists of color who had been invited to participate in the Whitney Biennial to show their film Good Stock on the Dimension Floor in Opera. The Yams withdrew from the biennial over Scallon's participation in the Whitney's history of white supremacy. And this was just a really big deal because I don't know if that's like a normal thing to do, but they were just like, we don't want to participate in this if like this work is also going to be approved by the Whitney. Michelle Garba, who is a professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, was one of the three curators of the 2014 biennial. And she, strangely enough, she commissioned both the Joe Scallon or Donnell Wolford project and the Yams Collective. So she was the reason why both of them were there. She said that Joe Scallon was actually the first studio visit that she did after she learned that she would be curating the biennium. I didn't realize how many people were actually like in on it. I thought like a lot of people didn't know, but like I guess a lot of people knew that it was like a catfish situation. And when she found out that the Yams Collective would be withdrawing, she simply said, given their discomfort, she respects their decision and was happy to be able to showcase their work. The Whitney's chief curator said that the Yams from the jump had expressed a lot of concern about the amount of Black and woman artists in the show. But the Whitney ultimately argued that they do not talk about diversity in numbers. As it was initially stated, there was 9 artists of color in the show. But once it was realized that Donnell's character was actually just a performance by a white man, that brought the number down to 8. The Yams Collective said it was troubling and insulting that the Whitney even endorsed the project. One member said the notion of Black artists being willed into existence by a white male artist, and that in the context of an art exhibition, the work presented a troubling model of the Black body and amounted to a conceptual rape. Another member, Krista Bell, said, "I want to clarify this is not about Joe Scanlon. We are not protesting Joe Scanlon or Michelle Grabner. We are protesting institutional white supremacy and how it plays out." The Yams Collective is made up of musicians, poets, actors, writers, and visual artists from across the world. I'm showing a photo of all of them. Their film was to be screened in March of 2014, but in their public statement, they asked the Whitney not to screen their work and to cancel it altogether. Instead, they had their film premiere at the Trinidad and Tobago Film Festival. The Yams Collective was organized by Sienna Shields, that's the singular person I'm showing. Michelle Grabner had visited her studio, and there was a like video loop of Sienna had made of her friends dancing in glaciers in Alaska. And then she was invited to participate in the biennial. And from there, she gathered these 38 artists, and together they all created a 53-minute movie that had 35 parts, and it was about race in America. The collective said that their participation in the biennial was an infiltration of an institution and of the art world, and that the size of their collective alone was meant to protect against tokenism. The most recent update about Joe Scanlon and the Donna Wolfer Project is actually in November of 2022. Black students called to get him fired because he said the N-word during class. And when the students mentioned it in class, he said that he used the ah instead of the ER, so it was okay. And then he continued to defend himself. And when the students went to the dean to ask for him to get fired, this dean said there was no issue in the discrimination policy and that he will remain in his role. Thoughts?
Well, my first thought, I think, to piggyback on what something Kamisha said a little earlier, was it seemed like he used black women to showcase his own points of view. Generally Black people, but he specifically used Black women, exploited Black women is what I'm saying, exploited these Black women to show his own views of art from the Black perspective. And I think you mentioned something earlier about him saying, oh, this would sound better coming from a person of that culture. So that's exploitation. To exploit Black women to make fun of our own culture, it's actually a little shocking as well.
It's not shocking because that's what people do. I also see it like he's not taking accountability of the fact that he is pulling from Black culture to represent his type of art, and whatever that art is. Again, it's just exploiting Black artists at its finest and not taking accountability.
What I meant by shocking was I'm shocked that the actors or actresses actually would participate. But I can get from their perspective that they see it as just an acting position, or maybe they can relate to it. I don't know. But it's still, you are exploiting Black women to make fun of Black culture. And why would any Black woman participate? Unless there was what's the goal? Ultimately, what was the goal of this character?
Yeah, and I think the two, when you saw in the photo, all of them are kind of young. And he is their professor personally. And I thought that was weird. Mm-hmm. I had a professor when I was in grad school that was like, I guess he was I don't know. I think he thought he was some kind of brown, and I think he thought that I could tell, but he looked white. And I feel like he would be like, oh, you know, because like we're down. He would be like talking to me and like the other black girl and be like, oh, because, you know, we're down. And I feel like this one time we were like, is he flirting with us? And I was like, oh, in some other context, like this would be, I don't know. I feel like we're both people who are like, I don't care. Like, would cuss him out. But it was like, I don't know. I feel like another person could feel like pressure to like respond to that. If you're like, I don't know, a young artist and there's like this adult fancy artist who's like, I have a project for you.
Yeah, I guess I see it too. Like, he's not taking accountability because, again, to y'all point, he was attempting to do blackface, but then when he got called out about it, he was like, oh no, that wasn't blackface, that was, what do you say, paid rich dirt or whatever he was trying to, you know, finagle it and trying to make it seem to be, rather than, again, taking accountability that actually that is what you were attempting to do. So just name it, own it, you know, call it out for what it is. But it just seems like he was just shucking and jiving when people called him out. Even when Ryan called him out in that article, he's just trying to find a way to downplay it, shift the blame to something else, and not take the accountability.
Agreed. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And then the thing you said about him saying the N-word in the classroom, it doesn't matter what it ends in, E-R-A, why are you saying it? What was the, unless you're reading something from
That's shock value. Yeah,
it is. But what's the purpose of saying that? What's the purpose of saying that word? Unless you're reading something and it's in the document that you're reading to the students in order to make a connection.
Skip over it.
Yeah, well, unless there's a relevance.
No.
I can see, if I'm reading something and I'm trying to explain it to you and that word happens to be in it and I need to read verbatim, that's the only reason. But just to, why would you say that in the classroom? And to think it's okay, that's the problem.
When I was in high school, it was a student teacher that came, a white student teacher that came to King, and he said it because they were reading Huckleberry Finn. And I heard he got cussed out. So they said, you should have skipped over it. So we could have skipped over it. And they cussed that teacher out, and they said he ain't never come back. The student teacher ain't never come back.
The only way I can see that being acceptable is, like I said, if I'm reading a piece of literature and that word happens to be in there and you want the students to get the full piece of literature without skipping over it, you're going to say, okay, this is a quote, here it is. Or have the students read along and say, yeah, we're going to skip that word, put it on the screen, something like that. I don't think as a white male, no one should be saying that in a classroom. What is the purpose of saying that?
I agree. Like, he could have skipped over it. I think when people take those risks, they are doing it for shock value or trying to attempt to be cool or down or thinking everybody is going to accept that without, like, reading the room. Like, read the room.
Mm-hmm.
You've got predominantly, if you've got a percentage of African-American students or even diverse students in that space, you wouldn't just say that word. But when people do it, they are doing it intentionally. Mm-hmm. I do believe it's always intentional. I don't think they're always thinking about the ripple effect of what happens later once you put that out there. To like Kiara's point about that student teacher. Obviously, yeah. Didn't think it through. Obviously, didn't read the room. Obviously, made a bad choice. But come on, you know what you're doing. You see it and you decide to say it out loud, it's intentional.
Yeah.
It's a choice. I mean, seriously, it's a choice. And you can also do a disclaimer about something too, like, hey, I'm about to read this piece of literature. It is got some words in here that, you know, might be offensive. I'm going to skip over that word, but still give you the context. You can do a disclaimer, but if you choose not to, again, I'm just saying it's intentional. When people put that out there, it's always intentional.
I agree. The disclaimer would have been made more sense. That would have been a smarter decision.
I don't think with the context of everything else, it was going to help. Like, you know, everything else he's done.
I want to go back. You showed those images of those two words, the two pieces of art. And okay, so originally when I, what's the purpose of those?
What do you mean?
Those. Okay, and I saw that. It reminds me of memes, our current memes that we have in social media amongst, because I can't really see it, what it says. But you know how memes have the same kind of feel as that? Here's something I actually want you to read and interpret this and personalize it. Said he played with the textures and all that stuff as well. Yeah. But I'm still curious as to what it says, because immediately when you put it on the screen, I was like, oh, are those memes?
But in person, you would be able to... In person, you would like have to step away a little bit, because again, like I said, we did see his work in person, but in person, you kind of step away a little bit, and it's still like you can't super read it. I think people have talked about this before with memes, like they like you have to identify with like the language or like the culture of the meme to like understand the meme, and I think there's like similar work being done here. Like you have to like. Not that you like had to be Black and American to understand the context of like the work. Mm-hmm. You are Black and American, you will quickly, or not more quickly, but you, if you make out the words, might be able to be like, oh, this sounds like a stand-up routine or from.
The Richard is undressing, that just feels like a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like not okay. A meme, but more just a sarcastic joke.
Yeah, and I think I read that Donnell just, or Joe Scallon, just Googled them, like just found them on Google, like printed them out on like an inkjet printer.
Okay, so he found someone else's joke, because I can't see what that says, what the Donnell Woods one says. So they found something and just print, let me go find somebody else's work and print it out.
Yep.
You say yes? Yep. And that's art?
People do that all the time.
But how can I take credit for something? I didn't write that.
People do it all the time. Just like she said, people do it all the time. They research it, they slap a different coat of paint on it and try to make it their own. Right here.
How? That's someone else's words.
It puts you in conversation with another artist. So like how I feel like Donnell Wolf or Jizzle wasn't a good project or wasn't just like good art, but if you would have thought about it in some more like initially it says like, oh, it like references the male phallic relationship in art and culture, stuff like that. If you're using that work to put yourself in conversation with the other person and finding like a creative way to do that, that's like a normal practice in art. I forget, like appropriation art is a type of like a practice appropriating someone else's art. But it's like, sometimes it's just like not done well. And like, sometimes it's done more well or like more interesting.
So would this be a case of more interesting or not done well?
I don't think it's more interesting. I think it's also funny that initially the Donnell character was like, oh, I don't know anything about like Lignon's work. And that would just be a really crazy thing for like a young Black American artist to like say. And so I think it's just like tacky. More than it's like interesting. Do you have other thoughts and questions, Mommy?
No, not at this moment.
You did good. I mean, I just hard for you to pay attention and follow instructions. So this is hard. I'm impressed.
I think she might have been off task a couple of times, but she looked like she stayed engaged. She did a good job.
Not so cool. I took notes. I was listening. And so those are things I wanted to talk about. I said, you know, initially those look like memes. I still don't understand how someone can take someone else's work. I can take your words because I put them on cards that make them mine now without giving you any credit.
You know what's funny? In my thesis, which you have a copy of, I wrote about this. And this is how I know you ain't read it. And Keisha, you laughing. I know you ain't read it either.
Because I just learned the English language or something.
Okay. Now we can answer our questions that you gave us at the beginning, right?
Yes.
First, okay. I want to say, Kira, I like your glasses. Those are cute.
Very cute. And I like that background.
That is nice. Nice to see where my money be going.
And it'd be nice if we had an invitation to visit.
Oh, we do have an invitation to visit. We just can't stay with her because Sweet Potato has to approve our stay. Yes, a cat has to approve us staying. That's what I said.
Why Sweet Potato in this?
Well, it's a cat.
Okay, y'all getting off topic. Let's go back to our questions.
What is your, do you need me to repeat the question?
I think it basically is.
Mine says advice for validating art parents, because you said I was a supportive art parent. And yes, I was. I will say my five pieces of advice. Number one, love your child when you love
them. Okay. I said Kamisha had five, but you could get five.
I just heard five, so I just went with five. So we're going to go with that. So first one, love your child. When you love your child, you support their ideas. You're going to support everything that they do. So support your child's dreams. So love your child, support their dreams. And even if it's something you don't necessarily understand, it's about supporting the dreams of others.
You don't, don't understand.
I do not understand. And I think that was my struggle initially, was trying to understand, well, what are you going to do with art? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? As opposed to saying, you're not me. Support your dream. Your dream doesn't have to be mine, and nor do I need to understand your dream in order to be supportive. So I don't have to understand what you're doing or understand the long term, what's going to happen. Just be a supportive person and be encouraging. And encouragement can come in moral support, but I believe also financial support, because those art supplies are expensive, and going to Blick every week and spending $200 on some brushes, I don't understand. Because you got the same brushes at the dollar store for a dollar. So I don't understand the difference why the brushes cost $200, but I digress.
You never spend $200 for any brushes.
I spend $200 on paints, brushes, and canvases, and they got all of that at the dollar store.
Okay, it's different quality.
I don't understand the difference. I don't understand what's the difference between Crayola and some acrylic stuff. Crayola make acrylic, and it was a dollar. But you want $10 for the same little tool, this big, $10. Well, when Crayola been doing good all these years. Why are we trying to exploit it? Or why are we trying to explore and have new options? Crayola has been working. Just want to point that out.
Would you like for me to answer my question?
You said you have five.
Oh, I just bunched them all together. Love your child, support their dreams, try something new, meaning the parent can try something new as well. I tried art once. I'm not good at it, but I tried it.
When did you try
it? I went to a painting sip class. That was my art.
Don't count. Painting and drinking at the same time don't count you trying art.
They go together. They work. But I tried to use like skills in the class, like the brush strokes and all that. And that's a lot of work. Oh, that's hard. So I just realized this is not my thing. It's a lot of work. And then I said, encourage, and then be willing to spend money to support your child. That's five things in there.
I will answer my question, in which I was supposed to give five tips, because I am turning 50. Do you get it, Kiana? Five tips, because I'm going to be 50. Get it? Okay.
Well, if I'm not 50, so I shouldn't get five tips. I can't get five and look on 50. What about 5 years old?
Okay, so let me get back to my part. Get back to my part. I think tip number one is just be authentically who you are. Just be who yourself. Like, at the end of the day, I move at my pace. I move to the beat of my own drum, and I do things even when others don't understand it. That's not about them. It's about me. I authentically, at this point, know who I am, and you should at 50. I think next thing is travel the world, like explore different places, different things. Last summer, I got a chance to go to Paris, which was on my bucket list. Always wanted to do it. So when I got the chance, I was like going for it, and it was great. So I'm on number four. I think I'm doing a better job taking care of my health. My wellness, that's a priority. And I do it not for
aesthetic reasons, like, oh, I want to look good. I just want to feel good. Like, I literally just want to feel good. I want to live a healthier lifestyle. I want to live longer. And I want to do it the right way. So when I, as I'm getting ready for this 50th party, I'm looking at old pictures of me and I'm like, oh my God, I look better now than I did in my 20s, you know, because I'm taking better care of myself now than I did in my 20s. In my 20s, I was eating junk. I was drinking, still drink, not as much, but.
Party flyer says, bring Prosecco. Prosecco is gonna be on the menu two different times.
But that's not like I'm drinking all the Proseccos all at one night, okay? Spread out over weeks and days. But my point is, when I look at pictures of me in my 20s and I look at pictures of me now, I look way better now because I'm just doing a better job of taking care of me. And last but not least, I think family and friends, like one of the major reasons too of coming back home. And you all know I had always been thinking about coming back home. I always would tell Kiana, I'm tired of this experiment. I'm good. I'm done. It's time to come back home. And once I came back home, I just got reconnected with family and friends in a different way. And that feeds my soul. That feeds my spirit. So money is money, career is career, all of that good stuff. But if you ain't got family and friends by your side to support you along the way, it means absolutely nothing. So I guess that's the thing. Like, we always, you know, maybe it's been ingrained in us for so long to career, get money, get money. You do all that, but that doesn't necessarily make you happy. It is the connections with others. And I was actually reading a report about this the other day. It's like, what makes people happy? It is about your connections with other folks. It has nothing to do with money and power and position or any of that. It's your relationships with others. So although I'm sad to, you know, I miss New Orleans to a degree, because I definitely miss the weather. It is cold here. And it's snowing. And it's I ain't built for all that no more. But coming back home, like I said, just connecting with family and friends has been great. Oh, last thing, I know it's probably six. Get a therapist. Now, Kiara actually sent me someone last year as a birthday gift for therapy. I don't know. She told me this was my birthday gift. I was like, what are you trying to tell me? You know? But I worked with this young lady for a couple of months and like it was great. And I had gotten a therapist before. And it's been great. So when I saw that message about Black people need therapy, it's so true. Get a therapist. They'll set you straight. They will be able to tell you things about yourself that either you're not ready to deal with, or you didn't realize, or the people around you just aren't comfortable telling you. I don't know what it is, but it has been amazing. And a lot of my friends have therapists too. So ain't nothing wrong with, and nothing has to be wrong with you to get a therapist. Like, your life could be totally fine, but still, it's another opportunity to dialogue with somebody about your dreams and your goals and all of that. So get a therapist, Black people.
If I can piggyback off everything she kind
of
said.
She does not have to piggyback off of anything.
No, I'm summing up. I'm summing up something you said that you kind of touched on, but you didn't directly say it. Choose happiness. As we get older, why don't we always just choose happiness? Choose the things that make you happy, because that's essentially what you're saying. When you say no, you do that. You choose to be happy because saying no in that moment made you happy. You didn't care how it made the other person feel. Choose happiness at all times. Whatever makes you happy, everybody else will be okay. They will be all right.
Thank you.
We were surprisingly good, weren't we? We were surprisingly good. We shocked you, didn't we?
Y'all normally don't act right, so this was shocking.
Well,
we are professional women. Did you not hear us tell our resume before we started this? We are professionals.
As a person who has hung out with you in your personal life, I know how you act, so...
And look at you. We've helped grow you. And look at how successful you've become.
Yes. Look at how we've raised you to be this beautiful, smart young woman. Just
travel.
You travel. You travel.
Yeah.
Traveling, cultured, smart, got some degrees with an S on the end. You're smart. Brilliant.
Just like your mom raised your auntie.
Well, half that right. I mean, okay, I guess she's smart. But
your insights. Yeah. Kamish, I feel like you've always been the auntie's. You do random stuff, but you do your own stuff. I feel like that has encouraged me. You know, you're more random than I am, but you've always been the auntie who's, you're going to do whatever you want to do.
You ran right, girl. I'm Aquarius to true and true.
You ran a marathon even though you wear heels every day. I don't know how you did it. You moved to New Orleans. Y'all started getting, I remember you when you guys got into yoga. I thought that was so random and such a weird thing to do.
And now you want to be a yoga teacher. Isn't it great? We got to take you to hot yoga with us one day.
You've been saying that every day since I was 14.
What? Okay, at least you know all the rays called hot yoga, as opposed to somebody getting you in a room and somebody locking the door and then telling you, oh, by the way, the room is 95 degrees and if they're going to lock and it's 90-minute class. That's how I found hot yoga.
That's how you got to learn. You got to just throw yourself into it.
That's another one. Sometimes you learn by just throwing yourself into it. Just throw yourself into it and it'll all work out. That's it.
All the time, every time.
That's sound advice.
Do you have any other questions?
No, this was great. Thanks, Kiara, for inviting us both to your podcast.
Thank you, Kiara.
When I started it and y'all said, we got something to say, and I said, it's about art, and I knew you wouldn't have that, but y'all did good.
We know about art. We are cultured women.
You have been around an artist for 20-some years, and you don't know just basics.
I know brushes and paints, and I know cubism. I know pointillism.
They go that cat. They go that bad cat. They go that bad cat.
Sweet Potato is a very well-loved cat. People love Sweet Potato. Only y'all are her haters.
She's looking at us.
Sweet Potato bad. Sweet Potato crack. Crack cat. That's a crack cat.
Thank you for your... Mommy, you said we were going to sing Kamisha Happy Birthday. You said you had a song for her.
I got a song for her.
You said you had came up with a song to sing Kamisha for her birthday.
Oh, I don't know. Was I drinking when I said that?
She ain't gotta say nothing. All she gotta do is next Saturday bring my cake and
next Saturday or this Saturday. Is it next Saturday or this Saturday?
Bring my cake and all that stuff. And we got the Q oil. We got everything, Kiara.
This is not related to the topic at hand.
What is Q oil?
Omega oil. Omega drink.
It's when the members of Omega Psi, every fraternity has a special drink that they make to drink on and pass out. So the Q oil is the one for Omega Psi Phi. It's which are known as the Qs. And they make this purple drink that is refreshing and has fruit in it. So it's healthy for you, because it has the vitamins from the fruit and the benefits of the fruit. There are other things in there that make you relax. So it's kind of a relaxing beverage that is made by members of Omega Psi Phi fraternity.
So are we gonna sing Kamisha Happy Birthday?
Oh, yes. Hold on. Go, Kamisha. It's your birthday. Go, Kamisha. It's your birthday. Kamisha, where you from?
Southside.
Where you from?
Southside.
Bad boys. Oh, no. Kiana and Kiara got to say bye-bye. Happy birthday.
Thank y'all. Thank y'all. I'm going to be 50. Look at me out here glowing.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to end it.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find all the resources from this episode in the description box. There you can also find my Instagram info and ways you can donate to the podcast. If you liked me and the stuff I talk about and you thought this was cool and you like art, please share with a friend or leave a review, and I hope to see you next time.